Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
Well, this morning I take my title and inspiration from the poem you heard earlier by Lawrence Ferlinghetti, Wild Dreams of a New Beginning, which was published in 1976 in a small book titled, Who Are We Now? And this poem is apocalyptic in tone and content, dealing with catastrophe, destruction, and then rebirth following destruction. A very common motif through Western culture and literature and religion. In this, it is in line with many of those traditions, except that it is not a religious poem. Plus, it has flashes of humor, which most apocalyptic writings don't have, unless it's totally unintentional. For apocalypticism has to do with destruction and end times, but it can also point to a new and better reality, but one that requires, in most cases, divine intervention. And there are plenty of apocalypses of that sort in Jewish and Christian scriptures. In Genesis, in the first book, you have Noah's flood. That's an apocalypse. With the new birth after, with this Noah and his family repopulating the world. We have a long series of apocalyptic chapters in the latter part of the book of Isaiah. And in the Christian Revelation, you have, of course, the Battle of Armageddon, the end of the world, and the creation of a new world after the four horsemen of the apocalypse ride through. And a whole new world is created, but one that is divine and unearthly, possibly. And the Battle of Armageddon, that's a location. And there are people in the world today still waiting for that battle to happen. Well, especially in times of despair or extreme injustice or evil, apocalypses appeal. In a time when people feel desperate, the promise of a divine intervention and transformation can give people hope. But with the poem we had this morning, it's nature and not the divine that intervenes. And it speaks of the intent, the extent, and danger of ecological degradation that was readily apparent in the 1970s. And people were speaking out about that, and not just this one poet. But it was in line with something that is part of many poets' writing, not all, but many, enough. And Ferlinghetti described this in a book he published in 2007, just a few years before his 90th birthday. I am signaling, he writes, I'm signaling you through the flames. The North Pole is not where it used to be. Manifest destiny is no longer manifest. Civilization self-destructs. Nemesis is knocking at the door. What are poets for in such an age? What is the use of poetry? The state of the world calls out for poetry to save it. If you would be a poet, create works capable of answering the challenge of apocalyptic times, even if this means sounding apocalyptic. You are Whitman, you are Poe, you are Mark Twain, you are Emily Dickinson and Edna St. Vincent Millay. You are Neruda and Mayakovsky and Pasolini. You are an American or a non-American. You can conquer the conquerors with words. A high and mighty proclamation of the role of poetry or any other art in difficult times. And yet, poetry has been the vehicle of not just of apocalypticism, but other kinds of prophetic proclamations for eons. Now, apocalyptic thinking writing can point just to destruction. And some of them do. But some can point to a new beginning, a rebirth in the world. The dream of a new start is a common theme and appears in many of the cultures in which apocalypses are common. The biblical flood, which I have already mentioned. The promise of a new heaven and a new earth in John's apocalypse in the last book of the Christian scriptures. And prophetic proclamations throughout various books of the Hebrew scriptures. As in the famous lines from Amos, "Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream," but not necessarily through massive destruction, but through social transformation. And one of my favorite apocalypses is the Norse Ragnarok. And the reason it's one of my favorites is that everyone gets killed off, including the gods. So a new start after that is really new. There aren't even any leftover deities. Except the world tree Yggdrasil, in all the fire and destruction, even though its leaves are singed, still survives. A tree, not any sentient beings. And science fiction abounds with its own apocalypses, stories of planets made uninhabitable, requiring either drastic social and scientific and cultural transformation or migration to another planet or even another solar system. Those two are in the apocalyptic model. And there was one movie I saw years ago, and I can't remember the title of it, but there the Earth had gotten so polluted that the governments of the world had agreed together to move, pool their resources and move another planet in from farther out in the solar system to where there'd be enough light and heat for the Earthlings to migrate there. A lot of this obviously goes beyond the reality of the possibilities of reality. But they are all aspects of what the biblical scholar Walter Brueggemann calls the prophetic imagination. The prophetic imagination, the ability to recognize something possible beyond the present. Maybe something so far beyond the present that it seems hard to achieve, but nonetheless challenges the present. Suffering or destruction or injustice. It is the opposite of what he calls the royal consciousness. And this is something he traces through all the books of the Hebrew scriptures, what Christians call the Old Testament. Those who spoke out usually from among the more common people or the lower end of the educated classes against the rulers, the royalty, those who dominated. The prophetic imagination is the imagination of the oppressed and their champions. And Brueggemann points out that throughout the Hebrew scriptures, it most often takes the form of poetry. Because poetry is not the language of laws, it's not the language of rules, it's not the language of royal command, it is not the language of management. It is the language of possibility and imagination. For example, the famous passage from Amos 5. I despise your festivals. This is purportedly God speaking. And I take no delight in your solemn assemblies. Even though you offer me your burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not accept them. And the offerings of your well-being of your fatted animals I will not look upon. Take away from me the noise of your songs. I will not listen to the melody of your harps. But let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. Not a physical destruction, but a social transformation. And so Ferlinghetti's poem is a 20th century example. But it still speaks today to the threats of climate change and environmental destruction. He saw apocalyptic desolation at first hand long before the 1970s. See, Ferlinghetti, who will turn 96 in March and is still writing and painting and running his bookstore in San Francisco, was an Eagle Scout. Now, I know I've put a lot of effort into bringing readings in from this side of the Hudson. He was born in Yonkers, on the other side of the Hudson. And grew up basically under the care of his aunt after his father having died before he was born, and his mother having had a breakdown and been unable to care for him as a child. And that led to all sorts of adventures. And being an Eagle Scout and having graduated from college at the start of the Second World War, he went and enlisted and became an officer in the Navy. He commanded subtenders during the Second World War, small boats sort of behind the boats on the front line. He was, in one instance, dropping Norwegians trained as guerrillas on the coast of Norway, which was occupied by the Nazis at the time, by Germany at the time, for them to engage in guerrilla warfare to drive the Nazis out. In the support boats behind the Normandy invasion, watching for submarines that might be sneaking up on the Allied fleet. And then 6 weeks after Nagasaki, being in one of the first groups of Americans to enter that city destroyed, 6 weeks after the atomic bomb had been dropped. So he saw what could only be described as apocalyptic desolation firsthand, and declared after seeing Nagasaki that he could never condone violence again and that he would be a pacifist for the rest of his life. And then in 1976, he could view nature taking back the planet from human degradation, hence the poem. But, and this is where some of the humor comes in, he had another image for environmental destruction. He called it Autogeddon. You know, Armageddon, Autogeddon. Cars were going to destroy the world. Yeah, there's the image of the freeway in that poem. You know, we're going to isolate ourselves in cars and not talk to each other. And then we're going to clog up the freeways so we couldn't get anywhere. And the world would grind to a halt. A more lighthearted evocation of a way of civilization ending. But you can see where it pointed again to trends, to real things that were happening that were not good. And so that's where that poetry comes from. That kind of pulling on deep cultural traditions, but speaking in a modern sensibility, raising up the possibility that nature would take back its own and that humanity might not survive it, something we consider today with global warming and climate change. But does a new beginning require total destruction? One would think not. Now, one more thing you know about Lawrence Ferlinghetti is that he's a philosophical anarchist. He doesn't believe the state has any legitimate authority over the individual. However, he says, in order for anarchism to work, everyone has to be a saint. And so he puts his energy into kind of a social democratic project. holding on to philosophical anarchism and working in practical ways. Being parts of ecological movements and anti-war movements and movements for justice for people who have been mistreated. And certainly as a leader in free speech, he was the publisher of Allen Ginsberg's Howl, and he won the Supreme Court case that ruled that it was not pornographic or obscene. But the poetry depicts vividly the threat at hand and inspires action from it. Calls for it at least from his fellow poets, but also makes me wonder, what can I do about the continuing ecological destruction? How can I help to restore the earth before it becomes uninhabitable? In the face of global warming and rising oceans, random violence in our streets, seemingly unending war abroad, and accelerating tendencies toward racism and repression here in the United States, we need some hope. We need some wild dreams to spark our action. We need the imagination that of something that may not be immediately possible, but which draws us forward towards something that is and something we can achieve. So we're at the start of a new year today, so I wasn't meaning to start with a downer about death and destruction. In fact, that's just the lead-in to talk about very briefly what the new year really is about. It's January 3rd, so I declare this a day to dream, a day to imagine, a day for each person to be a poet of possibility. Now, New Year's resolutions are very common, often quite mundane, and probably most of them have been broken already. Focused on changing a bad habit or tinkering around the edges of our lives. Why not dream wildly and see what we might come up with for a new year? How we might make a new beginning in these difficult, challenging, and one might say in some ways apocalyptic times. Wild dreams. I have some wild dreams. I still dream, after many decades of disappointment, for a socialist revolution in the United States. A nonviolent socialist revolution. We need it, and it can happen. Now, those who say that Bernie Sanders cannot be elected refuse to dream that there is a greater power than that of the ruling capitalist class. And it's important to note that Bernie Sanders, although he calls himself socialist, is not running on a socialist platform. He's running on a social democratic platform. Not the same thing. But that's neither here nor there. Just saying he can't be elected is saying we can't challenge the ruling class. All the other candidates talk within the language of the ruling class. But there are possibilities. And this is not about an election, it's about socialist revolution. The working class, the poor, and the members of the middle class, whose interests are much closer to those of the working class than the ruling class, might just be able to get themselves together at some point. Now, this likely will not include all of the 99%, which technically is really 98%. But that's a small number. But maybe 85% could get together. Maybe 90%. That would be enough for a nonviolent revolution. It, of course, would bring a lot of disruption and dislocation, and to the 1%, it would look like an apocalypse. Or as that great song says, it's the end of the world as we know it. Now, to me, it looks like democratic socialism, which would have, by definition, less centralized power than exists in today's monopoly capitalism. I also dream of an ecologically balanced world. Not a Luddite world, not a denial of technology, not a reversion to subsistence, but a world in which human creation and wilderness can both flourish. Because both can flourish. An ecologically balanced world. And I also dream of a world, and this one seems very far away this week, but a world where people of all faiths and ethnicities respect each other and engage with each other as equals. And that seems like a very wild dream today, but one much to be wished for. So those are my wild dreams of a new beginning on this January 3rd. And I invite you to consider what you might wildly dream about. Don't hem it in with the limitations. Dream. 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 So what are your wild dreams of a new beginning? I invite you to consider that as the service proceeds.